Film Festival.
Welcome to the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofeldt. In this episode, we're talking with Emily Mandavian, the writer, editor, and producer of Midnight Traveler, which is playing at this year's True False. The film follows one family's journey from Afghanistan as they flee the Taliban and document their time on cell phone cameras. Emily, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
So can you start by just telling us how you got involved with the film that would become Midnight Traveler? How did you meet Hassan's family?
I met him through a mutual friend, actually. So he, they first fled to Tajikistan, and that's where I made my first film. So I met him through another filmmaking friend that was there, and I programmed a short film of his in a festival that I was working at. So I knew them that way already.
So I had read somewhere that you were over in Tajikistan. I knew you were making your film there, and I thought that there was some kind of Fulbright connection.
Yeah, I had a Fulbright when I made my film, but I didn't meet them in Tajikistan. This is what's weird about it. I mean, I met them from a distance because they came after I had finished my other film.
Okay.
But he was very close friends with one of the filmmakers that worked with me on that film, who then was in the U.S. at that point, living in my house. So we became friends that way.
So you met him, and then kind of walk us through that. What kind of came next that ended in you?
Well, so since I already knew them, I was really concerned to see them get some kind of asylum or some kind of safety. So, you know, I was writing letters on university letterhead to UNHCR. I was asking other people to write letters. We were trying to get some attention to what was going on, and to the fact that they were facing deportation, even though they had a very strong asylum claim. And as it became clear that probably they wouldn't get any support for finding safety on their own, that's when the idea of making the film was born.
Okay. For the Fazili family, they were making this footage, they were shooting this footage. In the film, it makes it feel like it was really part of their plan all along to be shooting this footage and kind of both this assertion of their own humanity and their own, like, art-making, like, abilities and sort of, like, this is what we do. We're artists. Even though we're fleeing, we're still making art. And yet, you know, so it sounds like, but maybe it wasn't a film. It didn't sort of like come to become like this longer feature until a little bit later, or they weren't sure what they were going to be doing with it.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't know what form it would take. We didn't know, because we didn't know what the journey would be. So we didn't know how bad it would be or how long it would be. So obviously we couldn't predict whether it was a feature or a short or a serial or, you know, what it was. But you're right in terms of sometimes people say, well, why did they decide to film? And when we were editing, we tried a few times to sort of weave that in, like force it in through voiceover. But the truth is that that was obvious to them. It was like they're filmmakers and they're in this terrible situation and they are not the only people in this terrible situation. And they felt like this is what we can do. And they didn't have anything else they could do. So they were doing it, and it wasn't like a kind of, I don't think it was a difficult decision. I think it was almost obvious to them. It's like, well, we may as well be shooting because, you know, what else are we doing? Otherwise, we're just sitting around, you know, and just enduring this in silence.
Yeah, and also, like, we might as well be shooting because we're filmmakers and what we do is make films. And,
yeah.
And both of them, like Fatima and Hassan.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. So it comes naturally, I think. If you're a filmmaker, it's kind of just the natural thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for me, one of the things that happens, you know, with that, what makes the film so special is that it feels like I think it feels like it because it is that the Fazili family has so much agency in the film. It's strange to be sitting here only talking with you, I mean, for obvious reasons, Hassan can't join us at True False, or perhaps non-obvious reasons. You know, he doesn't have papers, and so he can't travel. That's the reason. But, yeah, I mean, it just feels like they have so much control and agency throughout the film. How much of that, how much of that editing process did they take part in?
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the complicated part of the collaboration, because obviously when they were shooting, they had total agency because there was nobody else there. I mean, it's almost like an improvisatory practice, right? It's verite shooting, but it's also your life that's unfolding. So that distance that you have as a director or a cinematographer with a verite subject, where you're kind of, it's almost like a dance, like they're living their life and you're trying to figure out how you're capturing it. When it's your own life, it's an even closer, kind of more immediate, almost intuitive kind of improvisation. And it does mean that they have a lot more agency, and it means that they, a lot of things that are not apparent or obvious to somebody who might have been trying to make their story from the outside are just naturally there because it's clear to them because it is their own lives.
Yeah, like what? Like the moments of joy maybe in the film?
Yeah, so like, that's something that, I mean, there have been a lot of films obviously made about the refugee crisis, and a lot of them are really harrowing and really sad and really terrible. But there can be something very dehumanizing about having just hours and hours and hours of footage of people suffering. I think to the point that almost we become desensitized to seeing those images. And in terms of what that, the how that reflects on the people, I think, is that often we perceive them as obviously in that position. Like, the only way we've ever met these people is as some person, like, you know, half drowning coming out of a boat. So we think, well, that's who they are. That's what they are, clearly.
Mm-hmm. We've only known them as suffering.
Yeah, we've only known them as people who suffer. So it seems sort of natural to us, and it creates distance between us and them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for the family, we meet them before they're in a difficult position. And we're with them for the whole journey. And the journey has a lot of ups and downs. So they're not just suffering all the time. They're also laughing. Like, they have a pretty good sense of humor, actually, as a family.
They do.
And they hold on to it. And it's like...
Yeah, there's so many moments.
You know, it's remarkable.
It's you know, it's funny or it's hilarious or it's hard. Like the boots. There's this moment where, is it Nargis or is it the younger
when
daughter?
She gets her new shoes. Yeah.
Yes. There's a scene where she gets her new shoes and she's really, like, I just love that scene.
So I think that's a big part of what you get when you have them framing their own story. But then to the editing, it was difficult because we were working from a distance. So I was getting all the footage while they were still shooting. And we started editing while they were still shooting and while they were still in kind of precarious situations and didn't know where they would end up. So I think and there was a ton of footage. Like, I mean, it was years of their life.
Right.
So it was a big task to figure out how to cull that and cut it down. And then to be working with someone where what you're doing is you're cutting their own life. So I've said to other people, I really don't think that somebody who came in as an editor at the end of the process, when an editor normally comes on, could have done what we did, just because I knew them so well and I'd built so much trust with them by being there with them, you know, producing from a distance across the journey. They knew that I knew them well and we spoke all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they trusted me to start making first passes on assembling their lives into a film. And then I could take those things and upload them and send it back to them, you know, via the internet, and they would watch it on their phones because, of course, they still only had phones, no access to computers.
Right.
And so that was kind of what the back and forth looked like.
My viewing experience was I was watching the places, you know, kind of as a American, probably somewhat in naive to, like, the pathway that the path that they're on, I was watching the countries tick by. And then at some point I stopped watching the countries and I really just, the numbers started, you know, it was like 200, you know, days or, you know, whatever it was. And it was, that was, yeah, I don't know. I guess it's not a question. It just,
well, that's really, I'm glad to hear you say that, because It was a debate was how we frame the length of the journey and how we frame the geography of the journey.
Mm.
And one big problem that we had was that most of the places they go are places nobody has ever heard of. So, you know, aside from starting the film with a one-hour geography lesson, there was no way to make you feel comfortable and oriented. And I always felt that was a great thing because they don't feel comfortable
and
oriented.
There's no orientation.
And they don't know where they are any more than we do.
Absolutely. And they're the filmmakers, too. I mean, that's the thing that's so unique about this film. It's just worth re-mentioning that this is a movie where, especially even for the True Life Fund, like, this is a movie where the people who are the recipients are also the makers. And, yeah, the people who are the subjects are the makers. And that's just so unusual in documentary.
But the day markers, they're meant to kind of creep up on you. You know, as you realize the way that the problem has shifted. And that was the big challenge in the storytelling was how to condense
so many years of somebody's life. Right, like, because it never quite stops being about place. How could it ever stop being about place? But it really, it feels like the time just starts looming so much larger. It's like, the life is just passing and they still haven't been able to, you know. And it's
exactly.
The time ticks on. And
that was kind of... That was the purpose of those, was to help us to understand how condensed this is and what that feeling is. Because, you know, being bored and waiting is terrible, suffering, and awful, and also not very fun to watch in real time, right? So
So being bored and waiting, is this why we have the Sartre opening quote?
that actually is a book called Ejdaha Yehudi, which means ego monster, by... an author named Saeed Bahauddin Majru, and he's a postmodern Afghan author who he got his PhD in France. He was a politician and a writer, and he had to flee and lived in exile in Peshawar in Pakistan, and he was a refugee there, and he was assassinated.
And the quote is...
And so this is the opening of his book, which is called Ego Monster, and book one, the book is in two books, and book one is called Midnight Traveler. So that's where the title of the film comes from. So at the beginning of the film, you hear this being read. And it's postmodern because he's obviously he's quoting Sartre and then he's like reinterpreting
it. So we get the Sartre quote in text on screen, and then we get the opening lines for him. Is that quoting him?
His book quotes Sartre. So it's like, it's got a few layers of meta.
Because I remember, I was like, now we're at No Exit. And okay.
So Sartre says, right, hell is other people.
Yeah, exactly.
And then in his thing, he's saying, he's posing the question, I don't think that's right, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's this, I think hell is within me, the road of life winds through hell. So it's kind of examining these other ideas about
other
what hell might be.
Isn't Hassan reading that?
It's Nargis.
It's Nargis. Okay.
Yeah.
That's right.
But although she says, I'm going to read you from the book my father's reading.
That's right.
So when I went to Serbia and was working with them in Serbia, I brought it because I think it's a stunning book, and it was written by somebody who was living in a similar situation to them. And it's a kind of under-recognized book. Like, he hadn't heard of it himself, even though he's an avid reader. And he liked it, so we decided to put it at the start of the film.
And there you have your title.
Yeah.
Coming up after the break, we'll have more from Midnight Traveler producer Emily Madavian. Hey, listeners, it's Allison, letting you know that this episode of the True Vols podcast is brought to you by the University of Missouri. And that is, in fact, where we are sitting right now in the KBIA studios at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. We're here with Ryan Vermeulener, news director for KBIA and assistant professor of journalism, and he is going to tell us a little bit about the Missouri Method. Hey.
Hey, what's up?
Nothing. Just want to know about the Missouri Method. What is that?
So... anytime you ask a journalism professor here about that, they always use analogies for it. And one of my favorite ones that someone at the Missouri in the newspaper that operates the journalism school said once
was... Oh, you got a newspaper?
Yeah, we got a newspaper and TV station, radio station. But this newspaper editor was like, it's kind of like you're an air traffic controller, but none of the pilots have their licenses. because we cut students loose. We just let them go crazy in actual professional newsrooms. And when I go to public radio conferences and tell them that we have 70 to 100 journalism students working in our newsroom as reporters, anchors, show hosts, producing podcasts like this one you're listening to right now.
Yeah.
And these people look at me like I'm crazy because they're like, you give that kind of control to people that you don't know if you can trust. And it's like, yeah, we do. And it's kind of like, you push the bird out of the nest, right? And yes, lots of them do fall flat on the ground, and that's fine, and that's part of it. And I'd rather them fall flat on the ground here than out in the world.
True.
But a lot of them fly, right? And they do. We've had students win national professional awards competing against professionals for stories that they've done here. Yeah, as students. Yeah. And they win all the student awards. They win, like, all the student awards, too. But even professional awards, Edward R. Murrow Awards, students have them on their resume before they leave here at the University of Missouri. It's crazy.
Welcome back to the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofelt. Let's get back to my conversation with producer Emily Medavian. I wanted to bring it back to the True Life Fund because I think one of the things that I admit that I'm proud of with the True Life Fund is that it's something where the audience has this opportunity to really, like, actually take action based on images. And I think it's Sontag talks about this a little bit with when you show images of suffering and terror or horror, you know, unless you can take action, really interrogating what's the value of seeing all of those. You know, there's some value, but to what extent? So I just wanted to kind of bring it back to the True Life Fund and kind of just underscore that opportunity that listeners have and that we have as a FES to actually give money to the Fazili family to actually take action and help kind of them as they continue their story.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it can feel very disempowering to be told, oh, there's absolutely nothing you can do. And when people have asked us, well, what could we do to change their asylum case?
Yeah.
You know, I can't honestly, unless you happen to be the president of the, you know, like the, you know, a member of parliament in Germany, like the truth is you probably can't do anything to change the case. You know, you're not an immigration judge. But there's a lot that can be done to help them land on their feet, you know. So the nice thing about the fund is it's enough people putting their money together to make it worth the time and effort involved in getting that money to them in a legal and safe and, like, good way. It's not super simple to get the money to them, as we've discussed.
Yeah,
so
it's not simple to transfer money across borders to people who don't have official papers.
Yeah, but this is enough. It's possible. And this is enough that it makes it worth setting up those kinds of, like, legal chains in order to make it work. Whereas with just a few people saying, well, I want to do something and here's a couple hundred dollars, it's hard to make the time, or it's hard for it to be enough to, you know, say, set up some of the legal entities that have to be set up in order for them to receive the funds. Right now they're in a camp still. I mean, it's not technically called a camp, but it's still like a shared living situation provided by the state.
It kind of looks like maybe an apartment style.
It looks like, yeah, it's an apartment style, but, like, for instance, it's a shared kitchen with multiple families.
Right.
So they have two rooms. They have one bedroom for the whole family still. So
yeah, it's very small, it looked like.
They've been,
footage.
You know, sleeping in one room, all four of them, for, like, 3 years now. Mm. So that's a long time.
Yeah.
And they're also out in a very, very remote area. And they're filmmakers. They're artists, right? So part of landing on their feet for them is to have the ability to settle in some kind of home where maybe they're in a suburb of an area that has media happening, because there's no work where they are.
Right.
So they kind of end up in this position where, again, they feel dependent and they feel like they can't do anything and they're sort of stuck. And for them, psychologically, doesn't feel good. That's part of why they made the film, is that they're not accustomed to just sitting around.
Yeah.
You know, they're accustomed to working hard, and they're, you know, they're not, this is sort of gets to the point of how you portray people, right? They they had a home in Kabul. Like,
yeah,
they had a
they were
a
working
life.
Filmmakers.
Yeah, I mean, he co-owned a restaurant. They
and
had
Fatima had films play. Was it? At
she was actually an actress
right?
on okay. Afghan television.
Wow.
Yeah, so she was in television serials, and her father actually won't speak to her because of that. She lost her relationship with her father over her acting career. So part of what was so difficult when they were fleeing was also just that they didn't have family who could support them. They have family who are alive, but they're not family who are well off, and they're not family, not all of them support their political positions. They both come from actually pretty conservative families that are not that supportive of them being in the arts.
And I think one of the other things that comes to mind too is what choices you're making. Like I noticed, for instance, the two daughters, a bunch of people in the True False screening committee also noticed, like, wow, they never seem to be fighting. Like there's moments where they're arguing, but it's really, they're not that fussy as you might think some two siblings are. And so yeah. I think a lot of that is because of the situation that they're in.
Yeah.
But it's also, yeah, these moments of like, what are we choosing to include? And
sure.
There's very few family arguments or, you know, and, right. and perhaps that's because they're all unified towards a common goal. But
there's one fight between Fatima right. and Fazli, Hassan, mm-hmm. I call him Fazli. There's one fight in the middle of the film, which in a side, you know, it serves as a kind of reminder that this is still a marriage and like normal.
It's not perfect.
But it also has some kind of thematic relevance to filmmaking and artistry and how you tell stories about life and things like that. So it's kind of on two layers, that scene. But it's an interesting balance that you're trying to strike, because on the one hand, you care about these people and you want to treat them fairly and kindly in the edit. And on the other hand, you want to show that they're whole human people. So that was a conversation I would often have, is like, can I use this, or like, is it okay for this to be in the film? Because
with him,
because I know, you know, like they've given me so much material from their lives, and like maybe some stuff ended up there that they didn't want in. They were actually very open about that. Like they didn't really ban me from including anything that I had. I think they felt like there was justification to allow themselves to be that open, which is a real risk. And I think it takes a lot of bravery. That being said, the girls actually do get along quite well. That's not like a cut. Like, that's not a cheat.
Yeah.
And I think it has to do with how tough the situation is, and kind of sensing as kids that in this environment, there just isn't space for you to add additional drama if it's not totally warranted. Mm. So, like, there's a few times where you see Nagus get upset or you see them break down. And it happens when they're in a camp and they're in a relatively safe space. That's the only time it ever happened in the footage. And I feel like that is a reflection of the kids, even though they're young, being old enough to understand when they have to hold it together.
Yeah.
Which I find really sad.
Yeah.
And then knowing now I can finally kind of just like
be a kid and sort
break
of
down and be annoying and cry,
like,
and
steal
be
your
upset.
Stuffed animal or something.
Yeah. Because I'm finally in a space where if I do that, it's not going to like endanger us.
Yeah. And the last thing I wanted to ask you about was the ending. I think with documentary film, anytime we're working with a true story that's ongoing, endings are tough. Endings mm-hmm. are tough, period, but endings are especially tough in nonfiction. And I think with this film, you know, I'm curious about what were his thoughts on the ending? Like, how did he see this film concluding? Just for our listeners, like, their story is, I mean, they're in a camp right now in northern Germany, right?
In northwestern Germany.
Northwestern Germany. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very, very much still in process ongoing, their case. Yeah.
Yeah. Where the film stopped, like, where we chose to end it, was definitely my suggestion, because that was one of those places where, as the person living that life, he's extremely conscious of the fact that it's all still in process and all still ongoing. And so it felt like, well, we have to wait for the happy ending. Mm. And it's very frustrating that the happy ending seems to always be receding into the future. So we talked about it, and I said, well, that's something summative. The fact that the happy ending that you envision for the end of the film keeps receding into the future. That in itself can be something kind of closing. And where they end is Europe. And all along they had said they were trying to get to Europe where they could apply for asylum. So the place that the film ends is the border of Europe. Mm-hmm. So in the sense of having reached their goal, they were there. And then as people who watch the film will see, it doesn't look like what they thought, what they reach. So it's visually, it's a very, it has a lot of, creates a lot of contrast. And then what comes after that, with the kind of trials and tribulations of the court system and bureaucracy and the rest of it, I think people are aware of, it's not particularly cinematic, and we always get that as a follow-up question. We knew we would, mm-hmm. right? Because no matter where they are, the next question is always, the first question will always be, where are they now and how are they doing?
Right.
So we could have followed them for 2 more years and that still would have been the next thing people wanted to know when the film ended. So we tried to choose something that, gave a nod towards the reality that for people who go through this type of journey, even when you find the kind of first immediate physical safety, there's still many, many years of bureaucratic things to go, many of which are anxiety-inducing. Because it's very frightening to be unsure if you can stay in the safe place you're in now. Like, having safety now doesn't mean a ton if you feel as if you might be deported. So I think that's, if there's something that isn't in the film that they're currently discovering, it's that. It's how hard it is to live with the not knowing what your future is.
That's it for this episode of the True False Podcast. Thanks to you, Emily, for joining us. You can find more of our conversations with filmmakers at kbaa.org, on iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by David Kuntz, with editing from Janet Saidi and Sebastian Martinez. Our music was created by Tim Pilcher, using sounds of the True False Film Fest. I'm Allison Kofelt. Thanks for listening.